From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!, broadcasting from the Democratic National Convention in Boston. Breaking with convention, war, peace, and the presidency.
You can't be a war president one day and claim to be a peace president the next, depending on the latest political polls.
Former President Jimmy Carter joins Bill and Hillary Clinton and Al Gore on the stage of the Democratic National Convention. But on the floor of the convention, delegates claim their rights to free expression are being violated. They say they've had their anti-war signs confiscated.
I'm just very disappointed that there is no ability to express any hope for peace on the floor of this convention.
We'll also hear from Congressmembers Gerald Nadler and Jim Moran, Florida Senator Bob Graham, as well as Boston City Council member Chuck Turner, and our major address by Cornel West. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, breaking with convention, war, peace, and the presidency, here at the Democratic National Convention in Boston. I'm Amy Goodman. Former Presidents Bill Clinton and Jimmy Carter helped open the Democratic National Convention, vowing John Kerry will win the November election. Carter delivered the harshest critique of President Bush, charging Bush can't run as both a war president and a peace president, and he criticized Bush for waging a preemptive war. Former Vice President Al Gore called on third-party supporters to vote for John Kerry. Senator Hillary Clinton introduced her husband as she called for improvements in health care and homeland security. Tonight's speakers include John Kerry's wife, Teresa Hines Kerry, former Vermont Governor Howard Dean, Senator Ted Kennedy, Illinois Senate candidate Barack Obama, and President Ronald Reagan's son, Ron Reagan. In convention news from outside the Fleet Center, the First Circuit Court of Appeals in Boston rejected an appeal by the American Civil Liberties Union and the National Lawyers Guild to force the city to redesign the so-called free speech zone outside the convention hall. The National Lawyers Guild responded to the decision by stating, quote, "This ruling eviscerates the First Amendment and gives the government carte blanche to confine demonstrators in protest pens at those important political events where free expression is most essential." The protest zone has been likened to an internment camp or Camp X-ray at Guantanamo Bay because the area is enclosed by a maze of overhead netting, razor wire, and chain link fence. During the day, protesters gathered at the area to protest the protest zone. In a piece of political theater, many kneeled on the ground with their hands behind their back to highlight the similarities between the free speech zone and Guantanamo Bay. The president of the largest AFL-CIO union, Service Employees International Union, said yesterday the Democratic Party and labor movement might be better off in the long run if Senator John Kerry loses the election. SEIU's head Andrew Stern told The Washington Post that both the party and organized labor are in a deep crisis, devoid of new ideas and working with archaic structures. SEIU, which represents 1.6 million workers, is officially backing John Kerry. But Stern said Kerry's election may slow much-needed reforms within the Democrats, which he described as a, quote, hollow party. During the primaries, SEIU backed Howard Dean. Al Jazeera is reporting that organizers at the Democratic Party convention have removed Al Jazeera's logo banner from its skybox and replaced it with a banner that reads, "Strong for America." According to Al Jazeera, the Democratic Party had approved the banner, but then removed it before the convention began without definitively stating why. In Iraq, an Iraqi resistance group announced yesterday they had kidnapped two Jordanian drivers. According to a video obtained by the Associated Press, The group threatened to kill the men in 72 hours if their company did not stop doing business with the American military. Meanwhile, an Iraqi group released the Egyptian diplomat yesterday, who they had been holding since Friday. Mohammed Mamdouth Kut was the first diplomat kidnapped in the wave of abductions in Iraq over the past several months. The United States, Australia, and Iraq's interim government have accused Manila of encouraging more abductions through the withdrawal. Also in Iraq, a senior hospital official in Baghdad was killed late yesterday. The hospital says he died in, quote, a terrorist act, but offered no other details. Earlier today, an Iraq garbage collector was killed, and 14 U.S. soldiers and a civilian were wounded in a mortar attack on a residential neighborhood in Baghdad. U.N. envoy to Iraq, Lakhdar Brahimi, recently issued an unusually critical comment about the Bush administration's war in Iraq. Lakhdar Brahimi said, quote, the war in Iraq was useless. It caused more problems than it solved, and it brought on terrorism, he said. The Guardian of London's reporting that new aerial photos from the West Bank show that Israel is building hundreds of new homes in a quiet land grab that's illegally increasing the size of Israeli outposts. According to the Israeli group Settlement Watch, Israel's increased the size of settlements by 65 acres in the last 2 months. A new Justice Department study found that 7,000 people who were barred from buying guns were able to buy them anyway in 2002 and 2003. Under federal law, gun buyers must wait 3 business days before receiving their weapons to allow for background checks. If the background checks aren't completed within 3 days, the sale must go through. This is Democracy Now!, breaking with convention, war, peace, and the presidency. We're broadcasting from Cambridge Community Television in downtown Cambridge, the unconventional city, just across the river from the Fleet Center, where the Democratic National Convention kicked off Monday night with a series of major addresses with some of the heaviest hitters of the Democratic Party. Former President Bill Clinton was introduced last night by his wife, New York Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton. Former Vice President Al Gore also gave a major address, which we'll hear part of in a moment. But first, we turn to former President Jimmy Carter.
The United States has alienated its allies, dismayed its friends, and inadvertently gratified its enemies by proclaiming a confused and disturbing strategy of preemptive war. With our allies disunited, the world resenting us, and the Middle East ablaze, we need John Kerry to restore life to the global war against terrorism. In the meantime, the Middle East peace process has come to a screeching halt. For the first time since Israel became a nation, all former presidents, Democratic and Republican, have attempted to secure a comprehensive peace for Israel with hope and justice for the Palestinians. The achievements of Camp David a quarter century ago and the more recent progress made by President Bill Clinton are now in peril. Instead, violence has gripped the Holy Land, with the region increasingly swept by anti-American passions. This must change. Elsewhere, North Korea's nuclear menace, a threat far more real and immediate than any posed by Saddam Hussein, has been allowed to advance unheeded, with potentially ominous consequences for peace and stability in Northeast Asia. These are some of the prices our government has paid with this radical departure from basic American principles and values that are espoused by John Kerry. In repudiating extremism, we need to recommit ourselves to a few common sense principles that should transcend partisan differences. First, we cannot enhance our own security if we place in jeopardy what is most precious to us, namely the centrality of human rights in our daily lives and in global affairs. Second, we cannot maintain our historic self-confidence as a people if we generate public panic. Third, we cannot do our duty as citizens and patriots if we pursue an agenda that polarizes and divides our country. Next, we cannot be true to ourselves if we mistreat others. And finally, in the world at large, we cannot lead if our leaders mislead. You can't be a war president Monday and claim to be a peace president the next, depending on the latest political polls.
Former President Jimmy Carter addressing the opening session of the Democratic National Convention. Earlier in the evening, former vice president and presidential candidate Al Gore addressed the crowd inside the Fleet Center.
Take it from me, every vote counts. In our democracy, every vote has power. And never forget that power is yours. Don't let anyone take it away from you or talk you into throwing it away. And let's make sure that this time, every vote is counted. Let's make sure that the Supreme Court does not pick the next president and that this president is not the one who picks the next Supreme Court.
Al Gore addressing the Democratic National Convention. Later on in his speech, Gore directly challenged those considering voting outside the two-party system.
Even though we meet here as Democrats, we believe this is a time to reach beyond our party lines to Republicans as well. And I also ask tonight for the consideration and the help of those who supported a third-party candidate in 2000. I urge you to ask yourselves this question. Do you still believe that there was no difference between the candidates? Are you troubled by the erosion of America's most basic civil liberties? Are you worried that our environmental laws are being weakened and dismantled to allow vast increases in pollution that are contributing to a global climate crisis? No matter how you voted in the last election, these are profound problems that all voters must take into account this November 2nd. And of course, no challenge is more critical than the situation we confront in Iraq. regardless of your opinion at the beginning of this war, isn't it now abundantly obvious that the way this war has been managed by the administration has gotten us into very serious trouble? Wouldn't we be better off with a new president who hasn't burned his bridges to our allies and who can rebuild respect for America in the world? Isn't cooperation with other nations crucial to solving our dilemma in Iraq? Isn't it also critical to defeating the terrorists? We have to be crystal clear about the threat we face from terrorism. It is deadly, it is real, it is imminent. But in order to protect our people, shouldn't we focus on the real source of this threat, the group that attacked us and is trying to attack us again, Al-Qaeda, headed by Osama bin Laden? Wouldn't we be safer with a president who didn't insist on confusing Al-Qaeda with Iraq? Doesn't that divert too much of our attention away from the principal danger?
Former Vice President Al Gore speaking last night at the Democratic National Convention. While Gore spoke out against voting for third-party candidates, some delegates on the floor of the convention explained or complained that the speeches coming from the podium did not reflect a clear enough distinction between the policies of President Bush and the platform of John Kerry, particularly on the issue of the occupation of Iraq and civil liberties. The events last night were highly scripted. Everyone in attendance was expected to remain on message. And as Gore and other high-profile Democrats spoke, some delegates charged their rights of free expression were being denied. Delegates for former presidential candidate Dennis Kucinich alleged that they had some of their signs and placards confiscated, as well as scarves they wore that identified them as peace delegates. On the floor of the convention, as the speeches wrapped up last night, we caught up with two Kucinich delegates from Minneapolis, Donna Cassett and Charles Underwood.
I'm just very disappointed that there is no ability to express any hope for peace on the floor of this convention. We've had our signs confiscated. We've had our scarves for peace, you know, delegate for peace confiscated. We've had people that tell us to sit down and be quiet. We've got no particular points for peace in the platform. This is becoming an extremely narrow Democratic tent, and I'd love nothing better to get behind a peace candidate for president. A little something, a little bone for us who want peace, and I'm not getting any of that, and I'm very disappointed. You see these people in the lime vests? Those are the Kerry enforcers.
And what were your kerchiefs for peace?
The kerchief.
Say delegate for peace and give Bush the pink slip. Which a lot of the delegates are wearing. We're finding a lot of the delegates here. We have common ground on the issues. They want to talk about this war as well.
And this is what they told you to put away?
They have been, yeah. It's just we're upset. We're off message when we talk about peace. It's that simple.
As Charles Underwood and Donna Cassett spoke, Charles Underwood, the Kucinich delegate, held up a pink kerchief that said, "Give Bush a pink slip." He said they were told to put the kerchiefs away. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back with Congress members and senators in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Miles Davis, Water Babies, here as we broadcast from Cambridge Community Television, just across the river from the Fleet Center, where the Democratic National Convention is underway tonight, the second night. One of the remarkable things about the convention is the high concentration of those representing power in Washington that just walk by you every day in the hallways as they're trying to race to or from their seats. So we had a chance to stand in the hallway and speak to many different Congress members and senators. On the floor, as we heard, some Kucinich delegates concerned that their signs were being confiscated, that they were being told they could not simply express what they wanted. In the hallway, we caught up with New York Congressmember Gerald Nadler.
What do you say to those, the majority of Democrats who poll anti-war, that feel that a strong message against war is not being sent here?
I think that there's some truth to that. But the reality is that I think most delegates here feel, I think it's clear, that getting into the war with Iraq was a mistake, that we were misled into it. I think you're going to hear a lot of statements from the podium that the president misled the American people into the war, that what he said wasn't true. Having said that, the question is now, how do you get out of it? And I think, I hope we'll hear some talk about that.
Do you sense a hesitancy to condemn the invasion outright?
No, I think we've heard that, and I think you'll hear more of that. And but I think there's a desire on the part of the party leadership and the presidential candidate to be forward-looking. Because the fact is, I mean, to be talking very practical politics, I think most Americans have decided at this point, and the polling shows it, that invading Iraq was a mistake. They know, most Americans know, that there were no weapons of mass destruction, that there was no real connection between Iraq and al-Qaeda, and that we were misled into it. And I don't think you have to, at this point, focus on that. People want to know, what are you going to do now? That's the question.
New York Congressmember Gerald Nadler, while he spoke out expressing his concerns about the occupation of Iraq, he expressed a very different view of the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza.
A lot of people feel that the Middle East conflict, Israel-Palestine, is fueling a lot of the animosity toward the United States. Last year, John Kerry said that the wall, what many call the apartheid wall, was a barrier to peace. This year, he supports it. He has supported the assassination policy of the Hamas leaders. What are your views on that?
Well, I totally support the fence. It's not a wall except in something like 1% of its length, but I totally support the fence because Yasser Arafat and company started a war against Israel back in 2000. They deliberately started it. They fomented the terror. They're continuing to do that. And you can't deny self-defense. And yes, the fence is very inconvenient and harms some Palestinians, but it's better to be harmed economically than to be dead. And the fact of the matter is that where that fence has gone up, it's cut the instance of terrorist attacks against civilians by about 95%. And I don't see how anybody civilized, frankly, can oppose a defensive fence such as Saudi Arabia is building with along the Yemen border now, such as China built. No one condemns those fences. This is a defensive fence. The wall in West Berlin was a wall to keep people in. This is a fence to keep terrorists out. And the Israelis have made it perfectly clear that as soon as there's any sort of a peace agreement, the fence will come down. It's a temporary structure. I think that Kerry's absolutely right to support the fence. And I think, frankly, most of the people who oppose the fence either don't really understand what's going on or are pretty hypocritical.
And what do you think of the Hague's decision?
I think it was disgusting. I think that what the Hague decision frankly said was that the Israelis alone among all people on the earth have no right to defend their lives. And it also made the assumption, which is not borne out by international law or by UN resolutions 242 or 338, that all the land east of the so-called Green Line is Palestinian. The fact is that land is disputed, and the boundaries between Israel and what should be a future Palestinian state have to be negotiated. But until then, there's no boundary.
New York Congressmember Gerald Nadler of New York speaking to us in the hallways of the Fleet Center. Nadler's view on what some call Israel's apartheid wall is not shared by all of his colleagues from the Democratic Party, people like Virginia Congressmember Jim Moran. In 2003, on the eve of the Iraq invasion, Moran was attacked by the powerful D.C.-based AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, after he said, quote, "If it were not for the strong support of the Jewish community for this war with Iraq, we would not be doing this." Last night, I caught up with Congressmember Jim Moran.
Many people say that until the Middle East conflict is solved, particularly between Israel and Palestinians, that there is going to be continued anger generated around the world. Last year, John Kerry said he thought that the wall was a barrier to peace. This year, he condemned The Hague and the World Court for condemning the wall. Your response?
Those people who say that we have got to resolve the conflict between the Israelis and Palestinians before we can have any kind of sustainable peace in the Middle East are accurate. They're right. And I do think that that we're going to have a at least a fair and balanced foreign policy with regard to the entire Middle East. We need to realize that the vast majority of Arabs and Muslim people want a better future for their children. And many of the governments in the Middle East are not providing that. You know, my own view is I happen to be a much stronger supporter of the Labor Party than I am of the Likud Party. I'm not a supporter of the Likud Party. I find them to think much the same way as the Republican Party in the United States. But it doesn't mean that I'm not supportive of Israel, and I don't understand the need for security. I just think there might be better approaches to achieving that kind of security and a sustainable peace.
You've been criticized for your criticism of Israeli military policy.
That's what you're getting at, yeah. I'm still critical of some of it. I'm not critical of the Israeli, the young Israeli people that are fighting on behalf of their country. I'm critical of some of the leaders that I don't think have been quite as thoughtful in terms of the long-term history of the Middle East. You know, basically, Israel's got to figure out how to live with its neighbors. It can't be an island unto itself. And that's what it comes down to.
We had on the First Lady of Israeli Human Rights, came here.
It's not Leah Rabin, because
Shulamit Aloni.
Oh, yeah.
She was a member of the parliament.
She's a terrific person.
And when she came here, she said that the stance of the administrations in this country has served to disempower the Israeli peace movement and the establishment Jewish organizations, the mainstream establishment Jewish organizations in this country, have silenced dissent that would support the peace movement. Your response?
I think there's some truth to that.
Democratic Party should take a stronger line, that the kind of criticism you came under has squelched a lot of dissent in Congress.
I think the Democratic Party is going to bring us a lot closer to a sustainable peace in the Middle East than the Republican Party. The Republican Party's policy has been one of disengagement and unequivocal support for the Israeli government decision-making. And I think Bill Clinton's approach was much more thoughtful and, I think, more progressive. He brought the parties together and said, look, you got to work it out. What we want is peace. We want an end to the bloodshed. And we want to know what is reconcilable between the two parties. And the Bush administration has not brought that about. And I think had President Clinton had another term, there's no question in my mind but that we would have a sustainable peace in the Middle East between the Israelis and the Palestinians, and we would never have been in this conflict in Iraq.
There's no. Do you think that would happen under John Kerry?
I know that it has a much better chance of happening under John Kerry than George Bush, because we've seen what George Bush would do, and it's nothing.
Congressmember Jim Moran of Virginia speaking to us inside the Democratic National Convention at the Fleet Center in Boston. Outside the center, beyond the rows of riot police and military police, behind the concrete barriers covered in razor wire, Palestine was on the minds of demonstrators. In the so-called free speech zone outside the convention center, dozens held a die-in draped in Israeli and Palestinian flags, representing the mounting death toll since the start of the Intifada in 2000.
My name is Tom Wallace. I'm with Boston Committee for Palestinian Rights and Boston to Palestine. And Boston to Palestine works with international solidarity movements sending people to the West Bank. Last spring, I spent several months in the West Bank as the media coordinator for the international solidarity movement. Today, we had a die-in representing the deaths of both Israelis and Palestinians as a result of the occupation, Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. And the ratio basically is 3-1. Three Palestinians die to every Israeli that is killed, and half of those are soldiers as well. So what we were doing here today is trying to represent and trying to put an end to American support for Israeli occupation and all of the money that America provides Israel in terms of whether it's for both financial support and military support. So it's time, I think, for not just a regime change in Washington, not just a face change, but a real change.
My name is Phyllis Bennis. I work with the U.S. campaign to end Israeli occupation. We're here today. We thought this was going to be a protest of U.S. policy in supporting the Israeli occupation of Palestine. We thought this is what democracy looks like. In fact, we find out this is what military occupation looks like. Fences, sharpshooters, walls, just like the Palestinians are forced to live under, only theirs is permanent. Ours is only for the length of our protest. We're here to tell the Democratic Party that we need a change in policy, the same as we need for the Republican Party. The policy of supporting Israeli occupation needs to change. We need a policy that will support international law, stop funding occupation, stop supporting occupation, stop supporting the Israeli occupation of Palestine, and stop imposing the U.S. occupation of Iraq.
Phyllis Bennis and others speaking in the protest pen, razor wire above, below a train track, snipers there, military police, riot police. Among those who also spoke at the protest pen was Boston City Council member Chuck Turner, who joins us in the studio today. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It's great to have you with us. You were there addressing the Middle East, but you are a longtime activist here in the Boston area around many different issues. Over the course of some 40 years, Boston City Council member Chuck Turner has established himself as one of the city's best-known dissenters. In the early 70s, he helped stave off construction of a stretch of I-95 that was slated to run through low-income areas of the city, at one point lying across Columbus Avenue to prevent construction. From the end of the 70s to the early 90s, Chuck Turner pressed Boston mayors for increased hiring of minorities and African Americans on city construction projects. In 91, Chuck Turner led a dozen protesters who occupied the mayor's office for 4 hours and forced him to make key concessions. More recently, he's railed against educational inequality in the city, the onset of gentrification, and the war in Iraq. This month, Boston City Council member Chuck Turner was a member of a coalition that sued Boston to allow protesters to march to the Fleet Center the day before the convention. He's been a member of the Boston City Council for 5 years. We welcome you to Democracy Now.
Glad to be here.
It's great to have you with us. So you have the Democratic National Convention in town running up an estimated $95 million tab. Here, the city has pledged $10 million for security costs. But if the private host committee designated to raise funds doesn't raise all the money, it looks like the Boston taxpayers will be making up the difference. Is that right?
I'm not sure the basis of that. That is, I'm not sure what responsibility the city of Boston has to finance the debt. Boston, too, it was told to us a number of times when we were seeking to get goals for participation of business people of color that Boston 2004 was a private organization. They're a private organization. They have not met their goals. There's no reason that the city should put its funds into that purpose. And contracts that were signed with the city. There's no commitment that the city has made, that the city council or the mayor has made to fund it. So I don't think it's our responsibility.
You have 15,000 journalists in town, 4,300 delegates, many thousands of protesters. Security in the city has been ramped up with local police, state troopers, National Guard, Secret Service, FBI, Homeland Security. In addition, 40 miles of roads have been closed for the convention. You have worked hard also to make sure that the convention is open for dissent. Do you feel satisfied?
Well, I think what we see is the use of large events by the security apparatus of this country to prepare us for the thinking that says that we have to conform to those who are telling us what to do. I think what we're seeing here really is an erosion of democracy. I think the tragic incident of 9/11 has been used to allow those who want to move us backwards and introduce an atmosphere of state control to play on the psychology of the American people. So I think this is just another example of the way we're being manipulated as American people.
Would you say that the convention has been good for workers in this city? I mean, you've got the firefighters arrived at an agreement on a contract just on the eve of the convention. The police as well, although they were forced into arbitration. And then you have Boston Globe staff, writers and others, who the Boston Globe sponsored the enormous media party at the new convention center, not the Fleet Center, which is way larger, with an actual Ferris wheel giving that sense of the media circus. And they had not had a contract for 3.5 years, Boston Globe owned by the New York Times. And then just a few weeks before, when they were threatening to bring out one of those huge inflatable rats at the party, they also came to an agreement.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's been good for some workers, and I think for other workers it is not clear yet. What you saw is the largest unions in city unions in Boston received contracts. They received raises of some 3.5 to 4%. If you look at the other unions that...
I mean, police got 14%.
Yeah, right? In over a four-year period, so it's about 3.5. Firemen got, I think, 10.5 over 3 years. So, but when you look at the contracts and you compare the contracts of the higher-paid workers to the contracts of the lower-paid workers, what you see is that the lower-paid workers in the city are receiving smaller yearly raises at a time when the economy is out of control, when the workers are having a very difficult time even staying in the city. Those who are getting more, and those who are getting less got less than the better-paid workers. It's an example of this country's mentality that those who have should be rewarded more, and those who don't. Shouldn't be expect to get the same. I voted against the contracts. I think they are. I think those contracts are penalizing those unions who have not yet settled. They don't talk about the bus drivers. They don't talk about the mechanics, the others who haven't settled yet, and they don't talk about how the funds that are being played to the police and the fire at that 3.5 4% level will affect the contracts of the other workers. There are other contracts that have been resolved at 2.5, 2.7. Why should the police and the fire men who get good base salaries, police are able to, every policeman earns $80,000 a year. And so I think the contracts really show us the difficulty of this economy where those who are really struggling aren't rewarded fairly and those who are doing well get more.
Boston City Council Member Chuck Turner, I want to thank you very much for being with us. This is Democracy Now! As we broadcast from the unconventional city, Cambridge, self-declared the unconventional city, just across the river from the Democratic National Convention in Boston. When we come back, Senator Bob Graham, and then Cornel West. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. That was Charles Mingus' self-portrait in three colors. This is Breaking with Convention, war, peace, and the presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, this week in Boston, a lot of discussion about the 2000 elections, a possibility of a repeat of what happened in Florida. Senator Bob Graham, who himself ran for Democratic nomination against John Kerry, comes from Florida. We talked with him at the Fleet Center last night about the prospects for a fair election in November.
Senator Graham, a number of people, including Reverend Jesse Jackson, have called for U.N. monitors for these elections based on what happened in your state, Florida. Would you support that?
No, I don't think we need to have United Nations monitors. I think we need to have United States monitors. The Democratic Party is setting up a very strong, extensive network of lawyers and volunteers, county by county, to be certain that all of the procedures are being followed. No surprises like we had in 2000.
At the time, Al Gore called off the protests in the streets. Is there going to be a different approach to people deeply concerned about the disenfranchisement of, say, a million black voters in this country, 2 million overall voters?
Well, they should be outraged if any group of Americans as a group are denied the right to vote. I'm not sure what you mean about calling off people in the street, but...
Calling back protests when people like Jesse Jackson wanted to protest in the street. Mainly the people who were protesting were Republicans rather than Democrats expressing outrage. Instead, the discussion, the decision was taken to the courts and not to the people, to the streets.
Well, there was certainly a lot of energy and a lot of concern being expressed in Florida during those weeks in November and December, and I was in the middle of a lot of that. But the ultimate decision in our form of government is going to be made by democratic means, and in this case, it was heavily involved in the judicial process, both the state judiciary and the federal judiciary.
Are you for the end of the of people who've been imprisoned in Florida not being given the right to vote?
Yeah, this is a new procedure. I was governor for 8 years, and my predecessor had been governor for 8 years, and our practice was once a person had served their sentence, served any post-sentence probation, and had lived a good life, almost automatically they got their civil rights restored. I would say in an average year, somewhere around 15,000 people got their rights back. under this governor, Governor Jeb Bush, each case is treated as a little trial, and the numbers have dropped down to under 1,000, maybe even under 500 a year. So there has been a dramatic change in the process. The result has been thousands of people who otherwise would be able to vote being denied the right to vote.
Florida Senator Bob Graham speaking at the Fleet Center last night during the opening session of the Democratic National Convention. Outside, there are hundreds of meetings and hotels throughout Boston and Cambridge. I went over to the Marlow Hotel, where the Tikkun community was meeting, led by Rabbi Michael Lerner. Among those who spoke was Professor Cornel West, professor of religion and African-American studies at Princeton University.
What are the prevailing dogmas of our day? Free market fundamentalism. The market is idle as fetish. The corporation ascribe magical powers. The private sector somehow having these mystical capacities to solve problems as opposed to being constructs of human beings driven by profit. What other dogma? Dogma of escalating militarism. The Thrasymachus view of Plato's Republic might make right. Raw force is a way you resolve conflict. If you're the big bully on the playground, you determine what morality is. It's an imperial mentality. I don't believe Bush is the only one who has that capacity and propensity. Historically, both parties have had it. If there was not an organized citizenry and a just rule of law to constitute countervailing forces against that mentality and the behavior that flows from that mentality. This is why I said before, we're not talking about political parties, we're talking about what principles and ideals connected to concrete human beings are we willing to speak honestly about? Because I don't believe we even ought to use the word democracy, small d, in the way in which Walt Whitman talked about it in Democratic Vistas of 1871, or the way John Dewey talked about it in 1927, the public and its problems, unless we're willing to be very clear that it sets a high standard, like trying to sing jazz and not taking Sarah Vaughan seriously. Trying to play saxophone and not taking John Coltrane seriously. Let's be clear about what the standards are. So when I hear a Democratic Party talk about democracy, what standards do you have in place? When I hear a Republican Party talk about democracy, what standards do you have in place? What would Frederick Douglass say? What would Cesar Chavez say? Socratic questioning. Inseparable from the Jewish creation of the prophetic. And I speak as a Christian, which puts me in solidarity on a very abstract level with 80% of American citizens. But my kind of prophetic Christian witness makes it difficult for me to stay in many of the churches because I'm suffocated by the narrow conceptions of what it is to be prophetic and Christian. But I'm clear about the Jewish creation of the prophetic, which is a courage to care and struggle for justice of Micah and Hosea and Amos and a host of others. And that, again, cuts across party. It cuts across nation. It cuts across sex, race, gender, and sexual orientation. It sets a high standard. And justice has to do with what? How do we keep track of the least of these, the most vulnerable, those who are marginalized, those who are demeaned, or those Malcolm X used to call are catching hell, the most hell. Decrepit schools, inadequate health care, unavailable child care, not enough jobs with a living wage. We can go on and on and on. We're here not to talk so much policy. What we need is a democratic awakening that accents a vision. Bush bashing is too narrow. It's too easy. A little won't hurt. As long as you're telling the truth. But for me, it also has to be said in a spirit of compassion for those who are suffering owing to the policy. I don't like the Bush bashing that is arrogant and self-indulgent and makes you feel good about yourself as opposed to knowing what the consequences of those policies are on the ground in Appalachia, in East Los Angeles, in Cambridge, in New York, Chicago, but also in Iraq, also in Afghanistan, also in Guatemala, also on the West Bank. On the ground. That's where we're talking about justice. And last but not least, I want to sit down. And these are simply just pillars that are requisite for a democratic awakening and to see whether a John Kerry and a John Edwards meets that standard. And if they don't meet that standard, then we engage in a discourse of phronesis, of practical wisdom, of practical judgment. Then what other options do we have? I make it very clear. Where's my dear sister, Miriam Benjamin? She's somewhere. There she is. That she and I traveled the country with Brother Ralph Nader, didn't we? Those were some magnificent moments. Brother Lerner was on board, too. Why? Because there's no doubt in my mind that Ralph Nader is a truth teller regarding the structural arrangement and institutional practices of the American empire and the plutocracy and oligarchy under which we live. Amen. And you can't be Socratic if you don't respect your fellow citizens enough to tell them the truth. They say, well, old Brother West, what do you think about Ralph this time? I think he's still basically right in his analysis. America hasn't changed that much since 2000. It's gotten worse, much worse. Well, how come you're not working with Ralph this time? He's still my brother. He's still an exemplary citizen. He has a right to run. I'll pray for him, but not vote for him this time. I make a different practical judgment in light of this present situation, but also ask John Kerry and John Edwards not to play this superficial game of rhetoric for one constituency and rhetoric for another constituency and not tell me what they really believe deep down in their souls in relation to the democratic awakening and the criteria that needs to be specified if you're honest vis-a-vis your citizenry. That's what I require of John Kerry and John Edwards, you see. And at the moment, I'm not excited. At all. Do we need a united anti-Bush front? Absolutely. Absolutely. Is it good that Ralph Nader runs around the country and speaks certain kinds of truths, but at the same time solicits more and more that could erode the social base of the Democratic Party? Tough question. Difficult question. That's the kind of debate we need to have as Democrats, small d. Because I'll have comrades on both sides. I have some comrades in the convention center. Fewer and fewer, but I'll have some in there.
What do you think?
We shall see, my dear sister. We shall see. But I'll have some comrades with Nader. I'll have some comrades in the Green Party. You see? And my comrades, I mean political comrades. I mean, for me, everybody's brother and sister who's going to be the culinary delight of terrestrial worms one day. So that's all of us. The last moment for me is what I call the American interpretation of the tragic comic, which is for me the most profound disposition of a Democrat that shatters all Manichaean views of us versus them. Melodramatic narratives of victims who have a purity and victimizers who have an impurity and somehow want to elevate one slice of humanity above the mess, to use Beckett's term, that we in which we find ourselves. And what is the great American interpretation of the tragic comic? It's the blues. The blues. It's Robert Johnson, Leroy Carr, and Bessie Smith, and Ma Rainey. And there's no way that America can deal with its darkest moment in the history, with the exception of the Civil War, of its fragile and precious democratic experiment, without wrestling with the blues. And since 9/11, America has had the blues. First time in the history of the nation, all Americans feel unsafe, unprotected, subject to random violence, and hated. Vast numbers of white fellow citizens don't know what to do because they've never been hated. They've never been unsafe. They've never been unprotected. Never been subject to random violence. Well, you know what? To be a nigger in America for 400 years is to be unsafe, unprotected, subject to random violence, and hated. So now America's niggerized. Got the blues. What can a blues nation learn from a blues people who have had to be both victims of American democracy but also sing the odes to democratic individuality and community in society, be it a Billie Holiday on the one hand or be it a Martin King on the other? What did Emmett Till's mother have to say in the face of American terrorism when her baby was lying in the coffin, his head five times the size of his ordinary head? I don't have a minute to hate. I'll pursue justice for the rest of my life. That is a level of spiritual maturity and moral depth that has to do with how you sustain a democracy. If the dominant response of black people to American terrorism was the response of the Bush administration, hunt them down no matter what, there had been a civil war every generation in this nation. Maybe, in fact, we've reached a point now where America cannot make it into the future unless it becomes a wholesale imperial project, completely eliminating any of its substantive democratic substance without mainstream Americans trying to learn from the best of people of African descent, not just as exotic objects or sources of amusement, but as integral voices in a rich multiracial tradition of voices, black, white, red, yellow, across the board. And in this way, the issue of race and empire has everything to do as to whether we actually lose or preserve this fragile experiment in democracy called the United States. And this is in part what the Tikkun community is all about with our multiplicity of voices, almost like a jazz group. We're not looking for unanimity. We don't believe in that. We believe in individuality expressed with integrity in such a way that the overlap of our voices constitute a collective performance that accents an ideal bigger than all of us. How wonderful this Tikkun community is. That's what we're about. Thank you all so very much.
Professor Cornel West, in one of the many sessions taking place outside the Democratic National Convention. He was speaking to the Tikkun community in Cambridge. And that does it for today's program. You can go to our website, democracynow.org, for contacts. Our remarkable team of people, producers Mike Burke, John Hamilton, Sharif Abdel-Qaddous, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, Nell Geiser. Special thanks to Julia Dengel, Dennis Moynihan, as well as Chris Zucker, Uri Gallet, our director, Mike DeFilippo, and Diane Andranikin, as well as Vaughn Simpkins, Susan Fleischman, and the whole Cambridge community television staff. DemocracyNow.org is our website. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.